Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk about books, ideas, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. My guest today is the art historian Matthew Israel, director of the Art Genome Project and also author of the book Kill for Peace, American Artists Against the Vietnam War, published last year by the University of Texas Press. He's talking with us by telephone today about the Art Genome Project. Hello, Matt.
How are you today?
Great. It's good to be talking with you.
Thanks for having me.
You're a Vassar graduate, yes? And I wonder if you could tell us about your background a bit before we go on to the Genome Project.
Sure. When I was at Vassar, I was an English major, and I took a good amount of art history courses, actually got pretty hooked via Art 105, 106, mm-hmm. and studied with Molly Nesbitt, amongst other professors, and after Vassar, was really inspired to get involved in the New York art world and worked for a number of years for galleries and for artist estates and artist foundations. And I did a PhD at the Institute of Fine Arts at NYU and was looking to become an academic. And mm-hmm. about 3 years ago was looking for different opportunities while I was job searching. Really, I'd finished my PhD and was kind of putting myself on the market and looking for different consulting things. And I actually got connected to Carter Cleveland and Sebastian Quillich, both the CEO and the COO of Artsy. Mm-hmm. And so the Art Genome Project is a project under Artsy. It's the search technology that powers the website Artsy. And the relationship is very much like the way that the music genome actually relates to Pandora.
Yes.
So it's the search technology underlying Pandora. And so I met with them more than 3 years ago now and decided, you know, after meeting with them, they were working on this thing called the Art Genome Project. I said, that sounds really interesting. I'd love to get involved. And I started consulting for Artsy about 3.5 years ago and then have been here ever since and quickly turned into a full-time job. And you know, at first I was actually pretty hesitant about working on something where I felt like I was putting art into these categories for a more mass audience. I'm definitely trained in establishing a lot of nuance, and Sebastian still jokes with me about this, but I said, you know, I contribute to it, but I really don't want people to know that I'm doing this. So feeling a little bit odd about this categorization project, but quickly just became really, really so interested in what we're doing and the educational potential of it that, you know, now looking back 3 years later and even after a year, just felt extremely proud of what, you know, we've been able to accomplish as a company and as a tool for people to get access to art. So
yeah.
So that's a brief biography.
The classification of art is something that actually art historians do seem to gravitate toward. You know, we just had a program on Abi Vorberg a few weeks ago, so you can think of yourself as following in his footsteps here.
One of the things that I was really interested in when I started was thinking about precedents for something like this. And as you said, art history is really so much about categorizing, and taxonomies are really fundamental to so many ways in which we acquire knowledge as human beings, whatever discipline you're in. And I think that there's, you know, there's always pluses and minuses of taxonomies, you know, that you don't want to downgrade nuance and complexity, but at the same time, it's really such a fundamental tool, and particularly for the internet now, I think we all can relate to being really overwhelmed with the amount of information that we encounter every day, and having a really intelligent way to actually sort through this is what a lot of us are kind of trying to figure out. You know, mm-hmm. how do we deal with all of this data that we find so interesting, but how do we categorize it in an understanding? And this idea, the Art Genome Project is really, in many ways, a metadata project. It's a sophisticated tagging project as a way to help people sort information. So that in that way, it's really very much like a lot of the way that we're dealing with the internet as a culture, where I mean as a world culture.
Yeah. Were you a computer geek as well as an English major and a person?
No. No, so, I mean, I always liked computers, but I didn't know how to code, and I was always interested in art, and I think when I came to Vassar, I actually thought I was going to be a graphic designer, because my first inclination in high school was to go to art school, but then I felt like that wasn't a practical thing to do, so mm-hmm. the halfway point was, or sort of one foot in practical, one foot in art was graphic design. So
yeah.
That had something to do with computers, but it was more about front end and aesthetics than about real back end and coding and things like that. So
yeah.
I think being here has been a real learning experience for me and incredibly fascinating.
Was Molly Nesbitt much of an influence? Because she's very much of the school of John Dewey and that, you know, notion that art is experience and it should be measured by its usefulness.
Incredible influence in getting me really interested in the field. I think just about the magic and the complexity of artists. And it seems very basic to most people who study modern contemporary, but she was really the first person to make me realize there was so much flexibility and ingenuity involved in art making that I didn't understand would be there.
Yeah.
In terms of modern contemporary work. I particularly remember with her, I mean, she's a Duchamp scholar, so I particularly remember gravitating towards what Duchamp brought to the field and then also people like Robert Irwin. So he was someone that she brought in to talk to the class, and I remember being fascinated by his practice and how flexible and minimal and also imaginative, and it just was very magical in that way. So I think so much of what my experience was with her was as a catalyst to get interested in it. And having been an artist, I didn't really feel like there was a lot that art criticism or art history could really bring to the magic of art making, but I felt, oh wow, here's this whole creative area which I didn't realize existed.
And it works both ways, of course. There's a lot that people trained as artists can bring to art history that art historians would tend to overlook in terms of, you know, technique and physicality of what goes into making art.
Yeah, I think what was very indicative of that was when we started out working on the Art Genome Project, it's literally just making a list. It's a controlled vocabulary, so a large taxonomy that is really over 1,000 words,
mm-hmm.
but those 1,000 words are major keywords in how people talk about art. And the first effort that we made was really around, you know, styles and movements, around techniques, around all the things that have to do with an artwork that are super physical, that don't really actually have to do with how things look and how they're made.
Yeah.
And I think we realized it was almost a secondary step to realize we really do need to talk about these physical qualities. And so much of where the field has gone is so much about theory and about the ideas involved, but forgetting to say, oh yeah, Donald Judd makes these beautiful, very uniform, rectangular objects
yeah.
in that way. And beautiful not being a category, but the way that we're actually paying attention to the physical attributes of objects was something that we had to remind ourselves of, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, it is.
So, you know, maybe that's the way in which there needs to be more thinking about that, and maybe that does come from artists.
Yeah. Can you talk about how a genome is structured? Because it seems to be, to me, quite different than what I'm used to as a librarian with a VRA core and Dublin core and those kinds of classification systems. And if it works like Pandora, first time I used Pandora, I have to say I was quite amazed that it could select for me music like the music that I had been listening to without my quite understanding how, you know, in terms of broad categories. So,
right. So in terms of a genome, there's 1,000 terms that are in the taxonomy that we've created, and this is a work in progress, so those terms could be reevaluated on any given day or expanded on or deleted if we don't feel like they're actually serving a purpose on the site.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, on the genome teams, we have about 6 people that are here doing cataloging, basically, for art all day long. We have people go through and evaluate every single artist that we get in and artworks that they made and basically give them relevant categories that actually apply to their work.
Mm-hmm.
And there's different actual categories that apply to an artist or an artwork. And the basic example I usually use is Picasso. So you might give different categories that apply to Picasso as a summary statement of his work versus a work that he made at the turn of the 20th century versus a work that he made in 1940. So those actually have different attributes. So we actually individually apply metadata to every single work and every individual artist.
Mm-hmm.
So basically they're tags in that way. But the other difference is that we have numbers that actually can establish a strength of relevance between a term and the work or an artist. So they actually can give the relevance and establish some nuance for the term when you're talking about a work. And a very basic example I give is when you're showing a landscape, and let's say you're establishing the term landscape versus the term truck. So we have two categories, landscape and then modes of transportation. And there's a truck in the background of a landscape that's very, very small, but you still want to indicate that it's actually a part of the work. So you give a very low value for modes of transportation and a higher value for landscape because it establishes that it's more relevant in the discussion than the truck in the background. And so what you're doing is rather than giving a tag, which is a binary attribute, you're able to establish some nuance. And so on that hand, there's a lot of judgment that goes into giving these values. But the downside is there's a lot of judgment. So there are things that are not objective. The plus side is that any way that we teach art and art history always has subjectivity involved and judgment involved.
Yes.
And that the usual example that I bring and that we bring to Artsy is that Artsy is not going to be the end-all, be-all scholarly resource for art, but it's going to be a quality jumping-off point for learning about art in the way that a survey might function.
Yeah.
So, in the way that we have 1,000 different categories, there are categories that, for you might not include in traditional metadata systems and cataloging systems. They are subjective terms, but they are terms that are actually part of the discourse and, the discussion around art and art history that's going on. So these are things that might be brought up in a class discussion, in a survey class, and in, writing about art, but that allow people to actually learn about art in a sophisticated way, and so that you're actually able to search through them on the site. So the way that we're creating these genomes and these tags that apply to artists and artworks, when you go through the site, these appear in lots of different ways. So when you search for an artist, you get a list of related artworks. When you search for an artwork, you get a list of related artworks. They actually sort all of our browse categories and our artist page, which actually has all these different categories for different ways in which to sort artists. So without it, you'd have just a massive database of, 150,000 works. We have over 20,000 artists.
Yeah.
And without something like that, or even with a basic sorting mechanism that might just be available for things like Medium or, let's say, the kind of more objective terminology, it would be very, very limited. So, again, the minus that we get is there's some subjective judgments going on. On the other hand, there's, I think, a real benefit for people that don't really have access to art and might not be privy to these discussions that are going on in college or university environments anyways when people are learning about art.
Interesting. So that by searching for art that they might like, people can actually learn something about art and the way it's classified.
Yeah, we think about it as a learning through search
mm-hmm.
technology, so that it's kind of a different tool for people. Let's say you don't know anything about art or maybe you're taking a contemporary art class, for example. I used to teach these at NYU, just an introduction to contemporary art. And if Artsy was around, I would have definitely recommended Artsy as a place for people to explore outside of class as a way to think about different relationships. So let's say we're learning about an artist like Kara Walker or Takashi Murakami or Jeff Koons, people that are commonly part of the popular discussion that you might have heard that maybe I only have time to cover in the class, but there's a whole world of artists out there that actually are quite similar and very interesting. So Artsy is a way to kind of connect with these other artists, learn about them. So when you search on the site, you get a biography, you get these related attributes, you can see recent work that they made. So it's a way to kind of expand your knowledge a little bit outside of what you're generally have access to.
Yeah. Do you happen to know, are people using Artsy at all in the schools? I noticed the site has lesson plans up, which I thought was
interesting. Yeah, definitely. We did a partnership with the Department of Education in New York City. So we're part of a pilot program called Digital Ready, where Artsy is actually being offered to certain schools as a resource for learning about art. And we know that it's actually being used in the classroom as a way to do basic things that people would be doing in high school curriculum, but also as college curriculum. I think the biggest use case is really as a resource outside of the classroom for teachers. We have over 25,000 public domain images that can be downloaded right off of the page that they're on.
Mm-hmm.
So as a resource for teachers to put images into their PowerPoint, as a way to brainstorm about images that they might not use or might not know of for their classes. And then for students, just explaining as a way to kind of expand their knowledge. And I mean, I gave a talk over a year ago. I was invited by an undergraduate group at Harvard that's associated with the art museums, and they introduced Artsy as the number one form of procrastination for art majors. And yeah, I think that's a great testimonial and compliment to what you know, we've been trying to do, which is people procrastinate with things that they like doing. So you know, it's hopefully in that way an enjoyable resource, and people are using it in that way.
Yeah. Does the system provide a tool so that someone interested in traditional works, presumably you have, you know, the monuments of art history in the database, someone interested in those can go out and find contemporary works being done by artists that might resonate with those older works?
Yeah, definitely. And there's definitely an ability to make those cross-temporal connections. So you can slice the database up according, theoretically, by 1,000 different categories. And then you add all the artists and artworks they have in the site, and there's lots of different ways that you can go through it. We also have tags, and I'm not even sure what the number of tags we have are, but there's thousands of those. So
lots and of a tag ways. Is different from a tag is different from a genome in that it doesn't have this sort of latitude.
Exactly. So the difference between a tag and a category is that the category actually has a value from 0 to 100, and the tag doesn't. So it's mostly things. Tags are things that you can see and identify, like you're looking at a work and there's someone wearing a hat or a boat, right? Things that don't really need a lot of nuance to them. But those are actually amazing ways to see these connections across time, where you look for, you know, things like you're looking for a skull. If you're looking for works that actually have something to do with mortality, that's an amazing way to see works of art, that you can actually sort them by date and then see works that were made yesterday that have to do with that theme, and then also going back to the beginning, you're seeing works that, Egyptian works, possibly, that actually have to do with that theme. So in that way, it's, I mean, I relate it to feelings when you're teaching and that amazing kind of riffing that people are able to do, where you make associations kind of on the fly, and it's that association-making ability that you can have these more serendipitous type connections bubble up.
Can you do more traditional kinds of things that one would do, one would have done with reference books, such as if you're putting an exhibit together and you wanted to locate certain works in public collections? Are there enough works in there that you'd be able to use it as that kind of a tool? You know, in other words, does it compete with Google's art project, which you can use that for?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely do that. We have works from over 200 different museums, private collections, foundations, and estates. So we also work with 1,600 galleries. So it's both for commercial galleries and also for museums. So in that way, I mean, we haven't talked about this yet, but Artsy both offers a tool for people that are interested in collecting art, and then a tool for students. So in that way, we do something very different than Google Art Project, where, let's say you're curating an exhibition and you're working on a certain theme, you don't have to just look at public collections. You can actually look at what's available in galleries now, which I think is a great tool in the way that it kind of can open up your thinking. And I think as an educator, you don't really make decisions around whether or not something's for sale or not when you're teaching a subject. You know, if you're teaching a modern artist or a contemporary artist and there's a work that's on view at a gallery, you're still going to include it in your PowerPoint and not say, oh, you know, I'm not going to talk about that because it's for sale. So it's a little bit more true to just the way that we talk about art and the way that the site actually functions. And in that way, the collecting on the site that we offer fuels the whole educational experience for the majority of our users.
And it must fuel it in terms of dollars also, right? And, I mean, it's the market side that provides your sort of economic base, so you can go ahead and do
this. Exactly, And I think in that way, it's, you know, it's not like a traditional endeavor like this, but at the same time, you know, we would never have access to the contemporary artworks. We have an agreement with the galleries that we work with to be able to show the works on the site. And without having a, you know, a commercial side of it, we wouldn't have any of those works. And, and I think, as we both know, there's the majority of students that are learning about art right now are learning about modern and contemporary art. So modern contemporary art can both serve as a hook to bring people into the site, because that's what most people know and gravitate towards, but can also be a real springboard to engage with art of the past in the way that we were just talking about, where you have these categories that you can see historical work, so you can compare Roman monuments to monuments of modern architecture or works of design.
And are people buying art online now, or do they use this tool as a way to find something and then go visit the gallery to see if they...
Well, we do both. So yeah. There are some works on our site which are actually you can buy right off of the site.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the works that we have on the site that are from galleries, you actually can inquire through the site. So we act as a kind of layer through which you can inquire. And then if you actually buy the work, you buy it from the gallery. That's the relationship they have. So we actually can connect the buyer and the seller through the site.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. So, you know, as an art librarian and somebody who's been involved with visual resource professionals, I know people have spent their whole lives working away on the VRA Corps, the Dublin Corps,
yeah.
and the Getty Thesauri, various kinds. Do you incorporate that work into what you do, or do you consider their categories when you're devising your own categories?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, the Getty Art and Architecture Thesaurus was really the starting point for us. It was one of the places where we looked to first for looking at our vocabulary. The big difference was that I think the problem for a lot of users with something like the Getty Art and Architecture Thesaurus is that you have multiple words for one thing.
Yes, yeah.
And what's most user-friendly is actually trying to settle on one term.
Yeah.
So that, you know, I talk to people about art history's created this incredible corpus of information, but you have two books that are written on the same subject, and they're talking about two slightly different things, and so those things actually don't connect very easily for people. And so, you know, what we're trying to do is bring those resources together under a similar terminology. And so what happens is you lose the diversity in terms of vocabulary, which most often has to do with historical works. But what you gain is you gain actually a more approachable database.
To some extent, classification systems become more about classification and less about the subject, presumably, that they're classifying, because they're all based on this essentialist Aristotelian notion that you can put like things together and separate the unlike things, and that this is somehow a formal quality of the work. But that's not actually how the world exists. You know,
it has to
do with use. And so it seems to me, you know, you've got something here that allows for latitude. And this seems to me, you know, extremely intelligent. Like I say, that's really revolutionary. I mean, I suppose it comes out of Pandora and Netflix and the computing world, not out of the library world, but it is interesting. So,
well, it's this incorporation of interpretation in that way. And that really has stayed out of a lot of browsing tools. And for terms actually to sit next to each other and still, one doesn't have to win against another
one. No, that's...
So you have a work that's from the 1950s that can have abstract expressionism, New York school, gestural painting, all these terms that might have to have some hierarchy with language.
Yes, yeah.
And they can exist actually on a parallel plane. You know, on one hand, it becomes problematic because, you know, you might not be on the forefront of actually settling certain art historical debates. On the other hand, you're allowing those debates to actually coexist and for certain terms and inroads to be found from a lot of different perspectives.
Yeah, I have to say it's a very scholastic way of looking at the world and appeals to my medieval sensibilities. So one thing I noticed about your categories, sometimes they're just sort of original. You know, I haven't seen them looking at our art categories, and they just jump out at you, and you wonder why no one's ever thought to classify works like this. And the descriptor I'm thinking of was eye contact. I don't think there's anything in any of the thesauri I'm familiar with that will bring you works in which the subject in the work, you know, whether it's a portrait or even whether it's an animal painting, indexes the fact that the subject is looking back out at the viewer and making eye contact. And when I saw that, I was quite amazed.
That's great. I mean, it's funny. We were actually talking about that. That was included in our annual review email. And I think on the genome side, we were like, well, maybe we want to have something that's more creative or more complex. And we actually were talking about it with other members of our team. And they said, no, eye contact is great because it's available. And so I'm happy to hear that you actually found it complex in that way and novel.
Yeah, and you can divide paintings into paintings that look back at you and paintings that don't, you know. So
it's funny, there was actually an article in the New York Times, I think this weekend, about the effectiveness of eye contact and how people really make conclusions about an intimacy of relationship based on eye contact. And it can have to do with both being in the room with a real person and also a representation, which was interesting.
Does your genetic code, like, you know, real genetic codes, does it evolve over time, or is it...
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that if we had a discussion with an artist that's on the site today and came to some different conclusions about the way that they've been given metadata on the site, we can change that, and the site reindexes in 24 hours. So it's very flexible in that way, and we can really edit our categories at will, and if we find that things are not working, we have 100% access to the whole back end of the site and how everything's working. I mean, there's a load time because what we do on the Genome Project is really create, it's really a glorified spreadsheet, really, of about, you know, if you think about every single artist in one column and then all the different attributes and values they get sort of moving out to the right, yeah. That's what we do as people with art historical backgrounds. But there's so much complexity that actually goes into the engineering of how all of this data actually gets worked into the site. You know, even at base, just how do you actually get all of this data to show up, and it reindexes when there's any artists or artworks that's added to the site. The whole site has to reindex so that there actually might be minute changes in a whole set of different results based on one addition to the site. So there's so many different moving parts that actually we can manipulate pretty easily. Mm-hmm. But I think we're just saying that there's, as much as it is an art project, it's also just as much an engineering project, because without it, it would just literally be a spreadsheet. And also, our designers are really amazing. You know, we've had endless discussions about how to represent this information, and our head designer, Robert Lenny, his mantra when we first started out was every single feature and every single button really had to argue for its existence on the page, uh-huh. Because if we're going to create a site for art, we need to really create a site that's worthy for art. So, you know, a lot of the different nuance and attributes we wanted to apply and showing all the genomic information and values and things like that were really not included, and I think for the better, because yeah. It creates a much more seamless experience and intelligible experience for most people that come to the site.
So how does the database scale? You know, I assume that the more works you have in it, the better it functions, but then does that affect your structure at all?
It does. I mean, we're really trying to give these attributes to every single artist and every single artwork we have on the site, but it's definitely a game of catch-up, as you probably know from any type of cataloging that you've done.
Well, sure. So it's very time-consuming, and you have to train people, and the number of works of art is infinite, isn't it?
So, exactly, yeah, so, exactly. Yeah. So I think that we know that this is a really valuable thing to do for education, for a basic browsing experience, and thinking of different ways in which we can scale and still keep the quality of that experience for our users.
Yeah. And one thing I should have asked up front, perhaps, do you have a way of defining what goes into the database and what doesn't? Have you had to think about the thorny question of what is a work of art, or is it a practical thing?
Well, I think we work with galleries and museums. So in that way, if we were working with artists independently, I think that would be much more of a question.
Yeah.
But because we're working with these institutions that are really giving us their artists and artworks that they have on their sites already, it's really less of a question. And I think that question of what is art, is it's not that relevant. I mean, you can ask that for anything on the site, but it's not really about our relationship. It's more just about the larger question of art that affects anybody that's putting it online.
Interesting. Do you see the project serving then as a tool for people who want to develop ideas about, say, exhibitions curators, or for people giving art historical lectures, or for students, obviously, trying to come up with ideas for research projects?
Yeah, I mean, I hope in all those scenarios. I mean, I hope that it can just get people exposed to new artists and artworks and new ideas, and think about the multiplicity of interpretation of certain works. And I think just also about, it's at base a freely accessible database with an accessible browsing tool that I think, you know, anybody in the U.S. can see it, anybody across the world can see it if they're able to go online. So I think in that way, it's an exposure tool for so many different uses, and we're not really exclusive to anyone. Obviously, we're trying to create an educational and collecting platform, but if there's so much different interpretations within either of those two sectors, that's, you know, any way that it's useful.
And the URL is just artsy.net?
That's right.
So great. So I'd like to thank you, Matt, for visiting with us today on the Library Cafe to talk about the Art Genome Project.
I think this has been great.
Yeah, it's been absolutely fascinating. Thanks very much.